It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, it is wonderful to be with you today on this thoroughly Jewish Thursday. I'm sitting in the American Bible Society, 1865 Broadway in New York City, a thoroughly Jewish city, and we've got a growing crowd. Hey, if you're out there, just make yourselves heard. I don't know. Go ahead. Sing. All right, there we go. In front of a live audience on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Now, Joey, just so you know, I'm having a hard time connecting for calls, but we may be able to take some calls, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. And if you're anywhere in the city, anywhere in New York, by all means, come by and visit us, 1865 Broadway. I'm on now, then we'll be on the next hour on Kevin McCullough's show right here on WMCA in New York City. And then beginning at 4, I'll be talking to everyone that's here about the new books, Authentic Fire and Hyper Grace. And then after that, we'll be doing a book signing. So it'll be between 4 and 6. But I have a special guest. Kevin McCullough, I want to tell you a little joke. All right.
I'm ready to hear a joke.
Because we're going to do this. Nationally syndicated radio host and best-selling author Kevin McCullough is sitting here with
you get
me.
Get two syndicated talkers together, you may never get another word in edgewise.
We may not need phone calls
at all.
Right. But here's the deal.
Okay.
Many years ago, the Pope called a rabbi and said, we want to have a golf tournament. And I am going to get the best golfer I can, best Catholic golfer. You get the best Jewish golfer, and we're going to go from there. Great, let's do it. So the Pope contacts Jack Nicklaus, who was still playing then, and contacts him and said, we would like to make you a cardinal. We would like to make you Cardinal Nicklaus, and we would like you to play against the best Jewish golfer out there. He said, great, I'll do it. So they go through the seminary, they make him Cardinal Nicklaus, the whole bit happens, and Pope calls, says, how did it go? He said, it was amazing. It was just amazing. He says, one of the best rounds of golf I ever played. I ended up 8 under par. It was incredible. He said, did you win? He said, no, I lost to a guy named Rabbi Tiger Woods. So you are now an honorary, thoroughly Jewish guest, Kevin McCullough. But you were telling me before the show,
right,
that you went to Israel for the first time recently and that it was an amazing trip.
I did. And I know you've got a trip coming up with your listeners that you're encouraging them to join you for in May. So I would encourage people, especially if you've never been to the Holy Land, to do that. Exactly. I had the chance. I was actually the guest of Prime Minister Netanyahu.
Wait. Hang on. You're Kevin McCullough, not Rabbi Kevin McCullough.
Right.
Not Kevin Goldstein.
No.
Kevin McCullough. And you on your first trip are the guest of Prime Minister Netanyahu.
There are some perks to being nationally syndicated. So what they want to do
I'm nationally syndicated, you know who's going to be in Israel when I'm there?
I
the Pope.
Well, there you go. Bring your golfer.
Yeah, I have to do that.
So they basically said, would you come? Would you? We'll let you write your slate for 7 days. Just see anything you want to see. Set your schedule, your time, your tours, everything. So I said, well, I'm a Bible-believing Christian, so I'd like to go to the holy sites. But beyond that, I'm very fascinated with modern-day Israel. So mm-hmm. I'd like to see your technology sector. I'd like to see your agriculture. I'd like to see some life in the settlements and some of the arguments that are being held there and just observe things for myself. I found myself being a tremendous apologizer for the United States when I was there, not an apologist, but an apologizer, because I feel like our current administration has been exceedingly hostile to our friends in Israel. Mm-hmm. And so there was a great opportunity. A lot of newspapers wanted to talk to me about what I was seeing and how I felt about it, but it changed my life. The very first moment I was there for all 7 days, it was unlike anything I'd ever been through.
Wow. All right. So I want to find out more about that, how it impacted you, and then there's a lot of stuff going on politically regarding Israel. We'll chat about
that. Let's do it.
All right.
Give us strength to all It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, thanks, friends, for... All right, there we go. Just live audience participation. Great to be with you on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. If we get to call us, 866-34-TRUTH. We are live in Manhattan. If you're just tuning in and you're anywhere in New York City, you got a little bit of free time or a lot of free time, 1865 Broadway, the wonderful facilities of the American Bible Society with a growing large audience. Kevin, would you say it's between 4,000 and 6,000 people that are here so far in the audience, or is that a...
maybe a bit of an exaggeration.
About 20 or 30?
We probably got 50 people somewhere in here.
So, again, we're going to be here between 2 and 6. I'll be on with Kevin McCullough the next hour, and then I'll be talking about my new books, Authentic Fire and Hyper Grace, taking your questions face-to-face, and then doing a book signing. I don't know if you ever heard the saying that the reason God created Gentiles is that someone had to pay retail. Okay, so I just want to throw out something cultural for you on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday.
There you go.
Because I added in a new category to it last night. The joke is heaven is, hell is, metaphorically speaking. Heaven is Italian cooking, French romance, German engineering, and British organization. Hell is Italian organization, French cooking, German romance, and British, French administration, French engineering.
Okay, that now I'm with you.
Right. Yeah. So German romance, Italian organization, French administration, and British cooking.
Those make sense.
So I added in two more, that heaven is Jewish wisdom, and hell is Jewish discounts. So just little cultural moments here. When we were talking in the last hour in your show with American Family Radio,
right,
you were asking me about coming to faith in Jesus and so on. It's interesting that many people have a certain misperception. They'll say, you were Jewish. Say, no, I am Jewish. I'm a Jewish follower of Jesus. And no, you can't be both. Well, I'm not practicing traditional Judaism. But the story is told, just to give you one other anecdote, then I want to go back to your time in the Holy Land, that in the days when the Catholic Church said you can't eat meat on Fridays, there was one Jewish guy living in the midst of a heavily Catholic community. And every Friday, he would go out, heat up his grill, and cook a wonderful steak. And, well, the smell of the steak would just go through. Waft through the neighborhood. And it was really frustrating for these committed Catholics because they couldn't eat meat. And so they said to the priest, "You got to do something about this." He goes, "Well, what can I do this?" "You got to do something." So he begins to meet with the guy regularly. And over a period of weeks, the fellow now becomes Catholic. And everyone's happy because no meat, no smell. Friday, everything's good. Suddenly, one Friday, a few more weeks go by, there's the smell of steak wafting through the community. So they call the priest and say, "Father, you got to go over and do something about this." So he goes over to the Jewish guy's house, and he's Catholic now. And he says, "What are you doing?" He said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Well, you're not allowed to have steak on a Friday." He said, "What are you talking about? That's not steak, that's a fish." He said, "That's not a fish, it's a steak." He goes, no, "Father, I learned that from you. That's not steak, it's a fish." He said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Remember a few weeks ago?" He said, you took me over by the water and you sprinkled water on me and you said you no longer were a Jew, you're a Catholic." He said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I took the steak, I went over to the sink, I sprinkled some water on it. I said, you're no longer a steak, you're a fish." Okay. When else are you going to get this type of cultural
wisdom? I'm telling you, it's unlike anything I saw in Israel, that's for sure.
All right, so when you were there, you've been following the Lord many, many years.
Since I was, I think that I came to Christ at about the age of 5, but grew up more or less in a faithful Christian home.
And student of the Word all these years. And
try to be. Who is completely? But
But I mean, you've been in the Word, and I'm sure you read certain stuff about background. You heard this Jewish background here, or here's the Old Testament where the thing actually happened. But yet you're saying, as happens to scores of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people, when they go to the land, the context was different? The seeing it flesh and blood was different? What happened?
I'm not exactly, I can't quite describe it. And I did not take the typical evangelical Christian tour of the Holy Land. I saw much of the old city. I walked the Via Dolorosa, did some other things. And then on Friday night, the first night that I was there, after a first full day, I asked my guides who were Jewish, I said, you know, I would love to spend some time at the wall tonight praying. And then I would love to experience a Shabbat authentically.
Why did you want to pray at the wall?
I don't know. I felt like I can't quite describe all the things that I had. I would say that the Holy Spirit wanted me to be there and to do that and to pray for the future of Israel and for the peace of Jerusalem and some other things. But in terms of, do I know for sure that it was God taking me there? I don't know. Maybe it was my own fascination with it.
Oh, but, yeah, and even that's why I was
wondering. But on some level, I think it was the Holy Spirit that wanted me to experience that, because I've not experienced Jewish culture in that context. And so to see the rabbis and the boys come together and then break apart, and the contracting and the breaking apart of the teaching and the singing and the praying and kind of the repetitive nature of it, I don't know what they were saying. I don't even have any clue as to what to begin to understand Hebrew. But I knew that these are people that God says he loves and that are special to him. And for that reason, if nothing else, then they are special to me. And so I wanted to be amongst them at this moment in time when my understanding is they are seeking the God of the universe and asking for his blessing. So that was a very moving experience. And then I actually had Shabbat dinner that night in the old city. The family that they put me with has people come through every Friday. They actually, you know, the IDF is composed of people that come from all over the world that come back to Israel to serve, and many of them are familyless while they're in the Holy Land. And so this one family in particular takes in about 30 IDF people per week that don't have anywhere else to go for Shabbat. They give them a meal. They spend the entire evening with them. They had English translations.
How did it feel to be with so many religious hypocrites that are just complete legalists, God haters? I mean, were you uncomfortable being around them?
Yeah, that's not exactly how I came away from my experience with them.
It shatters a lot of stereotypes.
It does. It really does. And, you know, most of the IDF forces, a lot of them young women, it's a very uncomfortable thing to be around when you're used to all-male military in other parts of the world. But many, many miles from home, Belarus, France, the other side of Africa, but they were all back there without families experiencing this. So the host, Abba Klaman is his name, and he said, he took me aside. He knew I was a radio host, and so he wanted to pick my brain about a number of things before they started the actual meal. So he's like, what does America think of Israel? And I said, well, two things, and please let me apologize for one. I'm sorry that our administration consistently tries to prevent your people and your government from doing what you need to do to protect yourself. I don't think that's right, and I don't think America has any business in monkeying around and telling you what is good for you. So I apologize for that. And unfortunately, our media tends to follow the administration's lead. So when the administration wants to kick Bibi in the teeth and make him wait for 4 hours very rudely at the White House as if he has nothing else to do, the media doesn't report it as anything unusual or bad or absurd. And I know that was very offensive. So I just apologize. But you have to understand something, that in America, evangelicals specifically have a love for Israel and for the Israeli people that is almost illogical and undefinable. All we know is that the God of the Old Testament is the same God that we see in the New Testament, and because there's this consistent discussion of how God loves the Jewish people, that Christians are supposed to love the Jewish people as well. And so while I come from America, I come from the church in America, and we love you, and we want to do all that we can to be supportive of Israel's future. He was like, would you mind telling our people this when we have dinner tonight? And so I said, well, I guess so, if you want me to. And so I think it was encouraging to those young people that had come back to Israel to serve their time in the IDF, because they don't hear that very much. They hear mostly what our media exports, and not a lot from what I was telling.
You know, the interesting thing is that over a period of time, the Israeli government, even some religious Jews, have recognized the sincerity of evangelical Christian love. Because the concern was, we've heard this before, mm-hmm. We love the Jews, you're the older brothers and so on, and when the Jews don't all, quote, convert, and mass. You know, it happened with Martin Luther from his gentle outreach in 1523 to his concern of the Jews and their lives in 1543, which Hitler used as a blueprint for some of his early steps or much of the strategy in the Holocaust. We've been through that. That'd be the Jewish response. We don't know how sincere your love is, but when evangelicals have made clear, whether you respond to our message or not, we love you. We're ashamed of a lot of church history. We believe that there is a purpose in your lives. And then the others will say, well, you just think we've got to fulfill this prophetic scenario. We have to respond like this, and then the rapture comes and this and that. When they've seen the love being steady for decades, they have realized, even the Knesset officially recognizes it, and there are many that do work together. Of course, some Christians then go to the other extreme and say, well, we shouldn't try to win Jewish people to Jesus because we don't want to offend. But that's being threatened. Now, the evangelical...
My best conversations while there was why I did believe Jesus was the Messiah.
Yeah, and there's a threat now to evangelical solidarity with Israel. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, here we are live in Manhattan. The crowd is surging to the point that they've had to put a barrier up to keep the crowd from getting any closer. It reminds me of when Jesus would be teaching and sometimes would have to push out in the boat because of the press of the crowds.
Are you now saying your teaching is equivalent to Jesus's?
Well, I'm saying if you compare the crowds, yes.
Oh, okay.
If you do
okay.
A comparison of the size of the crowds.
I'll be exiting this boat now.
That would work. I'm sitting here with Kevin McCullough, national radio host, best-selling author. Kevin, what's your website or the best way to connect with you?
The website is thebingethinker.com, all one word. And Facebook is probably the easiest, facebook.com/KMC01.
Got it. All right. If you didn't remember that, you'll hear it again in a little while. But we are in Manhattan broadcasting live. First time we've ever done this. First time I've done this.
Yeah.
American Bible Society, 1865 Broadway. So right now, Eastern Standard Time, it's a little bit past 2:20. We're going to be here till 6. So whatever time you can come, if you can come the next hour, I'll be joining Kevin McCullough for his show here on WMCA in New York City. Then beginning at 4, talking about my two new books, Authentic Fire and Hyper Grace. In fact, I will hold them up here to show that they exist.
That's right.
And talking about those, taking live questions from our audience, and then doing a book signing. So if you can't get here till even 4 or even 5, 1865 Broadway. All right, a question was asked. I know that you study the Word, read the Scriptures, etc., but you're not primarily a Middle East Bible expert, teacher, or something like that. But there are concerns that believers have, that God has laid out boundaries for the land of Israel, and God has promised the land of Israel, and if you mess with that, God will judge whoever divides the land, God will judge. None of this will say, we've got no business bringing Bible prophecy into politics. We have to be pragmatic. We have to look at justice issues, etc. Then the question of, okay, dividing Jerusalem, and of course, Secretary of State John Kerry and his stance. Do you have concerns? Let's get beyond the spiritual question. Because since Israel is not in right relationship with God and needs to turn as a nation to the Lord, to the Messiah, I don't see Israel in a state where there's going to be the fullness of boundaries or land or anything expected. God has brought Jewish people back in his mercy. He's scattered us in wrath. He's brought us back in his mercy. And he is working his purposes to continue to move his plan forward on the earth. But as you just look at the larger issues, the issue of Jerusalem being divided, the issue of American policy, you know, you're shaking your head. You have some concerns. Are they just biblical, or are they pragmatic, national as well, or do the two intersect for you?
They intersect a little bit, and I don't claim to be a end-time prophetic expert or anything like that. I love, my goal in life is to obliterate confusion and to amplify truth. So that's what I'm always kind of on the path of. And I'm a father of two young kids, 3 and 1 year of age. And I'm thinking constantly about the world that I'm leaving for them in the after wake of my time in this existence. And so there's a lot of things that weigh on me. And the role that Israel plays in the end times, in the role that God deems them to play for his purposes to be accomplished, that is on my heart and mind a lot. But then there are the pragmatic elements of this that if just simple understanding of I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. And I don't know that it's a pass to behave badly for the nation of Israel. And so I think if they did overtly immoral things that were causing pain on other peoples and so forth, I think that we would have to be very discerning as a nation in terms of how we interacted with them. My problem isn't that. My problem is that they don't act that way on the national stage. And yet our current administration and John Kerry and the president seem to be kind of alone at the top of this list in terms of to what degree they're willing to. But they're willing to treat them as though they're a bad player or an untrustworthy partner in world affairs for almost no stated reason. It would be one thing if there was a history. It would be one thing if there was some sort of rational decision as to why you need to check Israel and say, you guys got to put a lid on it here. But we ask them to do that all the time for no reason. And that frustrates me on a very large level, because they're not only our strongest ally in that region, they're also one of the reasons why there's any prosperity in that region of the world at all. You look at the literal desolate wastelands that polka dot the edges of that area. If it wasn't for what Israel has done in terms of reviving technology and commerce and industry and everything else in that region, you would have a much more depressed, poverty-stricken region of the world than is there.
We posted a cartoon. I think we did, Matt, Dry Bones, on our Facebook page, on Ask Dr. Brown, Ask Dr. Brown on Facebook earlier today. And it's a well-known Israeli cartoon column, Dry Bones. But it basically says this: the world is not concerned with Iran trying to get a nuclear bomb. They're concerned about Israel trying to stop them.
Yeah.
You know, this great illogicality. In 1991, someone paid $1,000 to get me to come to a Jerusalem Foundation dinner. It was $1,000 a plate just to sit there and to be part of a forum that Dan Rather was going to moderate with Henry Kissinger and Fuad Ajami from Johns Hopkins University, well-known scholar, Middle Eastern Lebanese political commentator. And I have to say, for the $1,000, McDonald's was better food. Just want to make that comment. But anyway, they did their presentation. And then at the end of the night, it was time for Q&A. So I wanted to ask a question. I was second online. The guy saw me. He said, no, you go first. So I had a couple of questions that I asked. But I asked the question, is there such a thing as a Palestinian people? Now, the question is not, do the people that identify as Palestinians deserve justice? Of course they do.
Right.
Should we be concerned for their well-being? Of course we should be. If there's any mistreatment towards them on Israel's part, should we address that? Of course we should. The question is there such a thing as a Palestinian people? Because there was no such consciousness of, quote, being Palestinians historically. So I asked that question of Fuad Ajami, and his basic answer was, no, of course not. The media is never going to tell you that. This is a Lebanese scholar. And I remember he made the comment, and this is back in the days of Saddam Hussein. He said, Iraq uses nerve gas on their own people, the Kurds, and nobody says a word. Israel uses tear gas, and the UN is in uproar.
Right.
There is this inequality, and somehow I have to see something supernatural behind it. Again, if Jews act wrongly, then Jews should be held responsible like anybody else. But there seems to be this strange double standard.
But on that note, I went into one of the days that I had in the settlements, and I asked specifically to go there. I got to sit at a private lunch with a man named Donny Dayan, and he's basically the top authority in both of those neighboring areas, Samaria being one of them, and then the one next to it, and the name is escaping me. But I talked about crime. I talked about life on a day-to-day basis. I asked about how people interact, because you have Jews living side by side with
exactly.
Palestinians in those areas. And he said, what is really astounding is that if there is a crime that goes down in one of the occupied or the Palestinian areas that are off limits to Jews the rest of the time, and they can't solve it for themselves, or violence gets out of control, it's the IDF that comes in and helps them recover the peace of the day for one another. In other words, Israeli forces are used for the good of the Palestinians, even against one another, when they are in those battles.
Yes, absolutely. Consistently.
Proving your point.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Here we are in New York City, live at the American Bible Society, 1865 Broadway. I'm sitting with Middle East expert, Hebrew scholar, and freshly ordained rabbi, Kevin McCullough, who is, can you make me an honorary Irishman? I was made an honorary redneck one time when I was.
I would have been much better at that, being a native Texan, but sure. And not, I can't make you Irish, no, because I'm Scotch. So
Scotch,
yeah.
McCullough, I should have known that. But that just proves that there are many areas where I do not have full expertise.
There you go.
See that?
You and William
each,
Wallace.
And we each need each other.
That's right.
During the break, I've been handed a number of questions, and there's a funny story. The greatest Orthodox Jewish scholar of the 18th century is called the Vilna Gaon. Rabbi Elijah of Vilna in Lithuania. And he was so brilliant that he allegedly studied and prayed 22 hours a day and would only sleep for 4 30-minute increments over the course of the day. During the winter, he would study with his feet in a bucket of cold water to keep himself awake, keep the shades down even in the daytime so as not to be distracted, and knew everything about every field and so on. So one time he was being driven in a horse and buggy in a carriage, and he realized after a number of hours as they were getting closer to the town, I guess driving through the night, that the guy was getting tired. So he said, "Hey, I'll drive. You get in here and rest." Now, he had gone to places, they'd heard of his fame, but they had never seen him.
Hmm.
So, but they were going to test him. I mean, it's Judaism. They're going to test him with a deep question, a difficult question, and so on. So the horse and buggy pulls in, and they've never seen him. So they go over and they open the carriage, and there's the buggy driver. They don't realize who it is. They think it's Rabbi Elijah, and they ask him a really difficult question. He goes, "That question is so easy. The carriage driver can answer that." So, one of the issues, Kevin, that many evangelicals have is that, well, God has one people and one people only, and that's those in Jesus. And if you say that the Jews are still chosen in any way, and I know you believe that they are. If the Jews are still chosen in any way, then that would mean God has two peoples. So, specific question, how many peoples does God have? In the Old Testament, Israel was his chosen people. In the New Testament, the church is called his chosen people. How many peoples does God have? Then, is Israel still considered God's people? And when will Romans 11:26 be fulfilled? All Israel will be saved. Then why would God give Israel a second chance? And this is Juan from the Bronx. All right, well, let's hear from Juan from the Bronx. There we go. In short, God has always had one people. There were those that were obedient to him and those that were not obedient to him. Ultimately, it's only those who are in Jesus who will be with him forever, Jew or Gentile. Jesus, Yeshua, remains the only way. But if God could make unconditional promises to Israel, for example, Jeremiah 31, verses 35 to 37, which follows the new covenant prophecy in verses 31 to 34, God says, as long as heaven and earth endure, no matter what Israel does, I will still preserve them as a people. He made these promises. If he could now change it, if I could promise Kevin McCullough and his children and grandchildren for all generations, no matter what you do, no matter what you believe, I vouchsafe this land to you, and then you cross me, I say, I now declare that Joe Schwartz is Kevin McCullough, then the whole covenant, all the promises are null and void. So there is one people that God has on the earth. Who does it consist of? It consists of all those in Jesus, and it consists of the lost sheep of the house of Israel. The lost sheep of the house of Israel right now outside of the fullness of his grace, outside of the fullness of his favor in the Messiah, but still chosen and loved. You say, yeah, but in the New Testament, only those in Jesus are chosen and loved. No, actually, that's not true. Paul explicitly says in Romans 11:28, after explaining that the turning of Israel will come, Romans 11:28 specifically says, now, as he's writing to Gentile believers, and he says, I'm writing to you Gentiles, he says, as far as the gospel is concerned, they are enemies, but as far as the promises, they are loved because of the fathers, for the gifts and calling of God are irrevocable. In other words, God doesn't change his mind, God keeps his word.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
We are here with a live audience. That was not canned applause if you heard it faintly in the background. I'm sitting with Kevin McCullough, national radio host and best-selling author. We're doing radio together today at the American Bible Society, hosted by WMCA. Let's just have a hand for WMCA here in New York, the amazing work they do. And we're sitting here live. If you can make it down, if you're anywhere in the New York City area, come join us. You say, I don't want to miss it. Well, hey, we're here until 6 o'clock today. I'll be on with Kevin in his show, his local show, from 3 to 4 all over the greater New York area. Then I'll be talking about my new books, Authentic Fire and Hyper Grace, from 4 to 5. Then taking your questions as well, then doing a book signing right up till 6 o'clock with the gracious hospitality of the American Bible Society. I'm not going to be taking calls, but we are taking some questions from our audience here. And I want to get back to one text, and then I've got a question for Kevin. Romans 11:26, when will it be fulfilled, and why would God give Israel a second chance? It's not a second chance. It is simply the fulfillment of what God promised in the first place. And somehow, in the providence and wisdom of God, at the end of the age, there will be a national turning. I was talking, Kevin, to a colleague who's a Messianic Jewish leader on Long Island. And he was saying, look, when letters like Romans were written, Thessalonians, that the vast majority of the believers were Jews. This is a Jewish Messiah. You've got all the Jewish leadership, the highest level of leadership, they're all Jews. The next level of leadership, they're Jews. Where do the Gentiles fit? How do I fit in this? And he was saying it would be as if every major Christian leader you can think of, you know, the Billy Grahams and this, they're all Jews.
Right.
I'm a Gentile. Where do I fit? Things shifted quite radically to the point that when a Jew gets saved, we've had friends of mine, this has happened, when a Jew gets saved, they give them a ham sandwich to see if they're really saved. You know, you have to become a Gentile in somehow in order to be saved. Well, God has spoken, Romans 11:25, when the fullness of the Gentiles comes in. Well, Paul says this, I don't want you to be ignorant lest you become arrogant. I don't want you to be ignorant of this mystery. The mystery is not some hidden thing like a mystery novel. One Christian author said, well, it was a mystery to Paul, it's a mystery to me. No, he says, I don't want you to be ignorant of this mystery. Mystery being something that was hidden previously in the scriptures that's now revealed in these end times. I don't want you to be ignorant of this mystery lest you become arrogant. What's the ignorance? God's finished with Israel. God's done with Israel. He's cast them off. We are the new kids in the block. We have now taken over. And Paul writes to the Gentiles to warn them about arrogance based on ignorance, and then says that when the fullness of the Gentiles comes in on the heels of that, or provoked by that, and so all Israel will be saved, a national turning. Paul never uses the word Israel in the book of Romans except chapters 9, 10, 11. He refers to Jews a lot, but he never uses Israel because these are corporate issues. Romans 9, 10, and 11, and speaks of a national turning. Your reform, your Calvinist, and your background, you could believe that God could set things up in a certain way, that in a certain generation there'd be a massive harvest. We know that Jesus says the harvest is the end of the age. We know that with the outpouring of the Spirit in Acts 2 at Shavuot Pentecost, that this is for the last days, the Spirit being poured out on all flesh. Whoever calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. We know all that to be true. And we see the gospel spreading in regions, Muslim regions, others, like it's never spread before. So why not also a great spreading among the lost sheep of the house of Israel? But you know a lot of evangelical leaders. You've been well connected across large segments of the body for years. There seems to be a change in heart among many of the leaders. The Jews are not the victims so much now. The Holocaust is almost forgotten. Not as many pictures of Jews getting blown up in the streets, suicide bombers. They're now the powerful ones. Mm-hmm. They are, especially young people seem to be picking up a narrative which has a heart for justice but is not based on truth. Just like I want to side with the gay couple. Why can't they marry? You know, they care about them, but it's not based on truth. I see the same thing often in the Middle East, and more evangelical leaders, a minority, but more and more losing a heart for Israel. Are you seeing that? And if so, does it concern you?
No, it does. And one of the things that has bothered me greatly, and it kind of dovetails with some of the other movements. The less biblically literate the church is, the more anti-Israel they become.
Isn't that something?
The less understanding of the Old Testament that they have, the more anti-Israel they have become. And in our newest movements, where you have Emergent and Hyper Grace, which you know a little bit about, and some of the even more emotionally driven elements of what would loosely be under the Christian umbrella. And I say that loosely because I think if you take out core components of any recipe, you stop getting what that recipe creates.
Exactly.
Right? So you take flour out of cake and put sand in and put it in the oven. You can bake it. You can slice it up. You can put icing on it. You eat it. You're not eating cake. You're eating something else. Same thing with marriage. Same thing with the church. You take core components of truth of who God is and what he is about out of the story. You've changed fundamentally what Christianity or the understanding of how to follow Jesus has always been intended to be believed. And so I think that the further the modern church has embraced not specifically the Palestinian cause, but worldliness, the more they have turned their back on God's first people, the children of Israel.
And if God could do that, if God could ultimately cast off Israel because Israel sins, and God would not deal with them based on grace. Now, we understand each individual stands or falls before God individually. Jesus, Yeshua, remains the only way to God. We understand that there are many judgments that have come on the Jewish people over the centuries, through the years. But if God could cast us off because of our failures, I say us as a Jew, then what about
the church?
The church
is doomed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I don't understand, and I asked Reverend Sizer this, what's so hard about thinking God deals by grace with Israel as well?
Yeah. Well, you have more patience with me in that you refer to Reverend Sizer as Reverend Sizer. So I'm hardcore. I want people to believe the text. I want to obliterate confusion and amplify truth. So I want them to understand, if God has said that the children of Israel and the nation of Israel and the people of Israel are important to him, it's not for naught. God doesn't waste time, and he doesn't say things that aren't true or aren't consistent with who he is. So whatever the working out of it is in a theological context, that's okay. God's big enough to be able to handle that. The question becomes, how do I respond to those that he says he loves? And as a non-Jewish evangelical in America, I am to have a heart for the people in the land of Israel because it's close to God's heart.
Amen. The book that I wrote that has been the most translated and has been steadily in print without ever going out of print since 1992, Our Hands Are Stained with Blood, recounts a lot of church history and even some of the media bias and other things like that. And I've had Christians read it around the world. I remember the Chinese translator emailed me, said, I'm translating screaming and wailing. There's such a shock to read some of the parts of church history. And you say, okay, well, they weren't really Christian. Well, many obviously weren't. But some were well-known leaders, very well-known leaders, who said very, very ugly things, demonizing things against the Jews. I would think that when a Christian reads that, there's such a sense of shame to say, I want to demonstrate what a real follower of Jesus looks like.
I would hope so.
And what's also interesting when you mentioned just the plain sense of things, when Paul writes explicitly and says they may be enemies for the gospel, they are enemies for the gospel, but they are loved on account of the fathers, because the gifts and calling of God are irrevocable. People say, well, that makes God a racist. No. It means God keeps his word. It means he's faithful to his promises.
Dr. Brown, Michael, if there is no promise that God can keep to the children of Israel, then the church has no hope whatsoever.
Exactly.
God does not change the stripe or color of who he is because of the era or the day in which we live. And if he's not going to keep his promise to one, he won't keep his promise to the other. So the hope for the Christian only comes in the promise-keeping God that first said he loved the Jew.
Absolutely. And listen, we've never... Absolutely. I'll applaud for that. We've never talked about this before.
No.
We've chatted about other things. We've never talked about this. So it thrills me to hear not just your heart, but the clarity of thought behind it. Because if there's not clarity of thought behind it, then you know, you could get moved sometimes, or when the narrative changes, if it's just emotion based. So this is truth based for us. An opinion here. Do you think the U.S. will support Israel if they need to strike? What's your opinion?
I would hope that they would. I am very fearful that the current government would not.
Yeah, I'm concerned as well. My guess, and I don't have some political insiders telling me more, that there would be more, perhaps a covert support, outwardly make it look like we're hands off, but covert support, because I think we recognize that Israel cannot be threatened and that a nuclear Iran. There's a quote where they said, look, we're going to have a nuclear weapon and we want a nuclear weapon because we got to destroy Israel. This is circulating just these days.
Well, and right after Israel, they said we want to come after America, too. So, I mean, it's not like I've found that the promises of madmen generally should be believed because they make them and then they usually try to act out upon them. And we've seen that historically, right? I mean,
yes,
Hitler was saying for years what he wanted to do before he did it. So when you've got people saying, yeah, we want to destroy what they consider to be the great Satan, we should pay attention to that. I'm just afraid that with this current administration that we won't.
Yep. So we need to pray. We're just speculating,
always.
But we need to pray. All right, we will be right back. Right here on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday with my thoroughly Jewish guest, Kevin McCall.
Fire we want, for fire we please.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, I have a very big question on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. If you're listening to me and you've been thinking about signing up for our Israel tour in May, what is stopping you? I know when it was October. I think, wow, it's May's alone. But May's coming quickly. May 20th to 30th. Join with my dear friend Scott Volk. Just going to Israel with Scott is worth it alone. We're actually going to do, Kevin, we're going to do live radio, God willing, from Israel. We'll set up some arrangements in the hotel because it's just evening in Israel. We're also going to connect with some of the Messianic Jewish believers and some Palestinian Christians who love Israel. And fascinatingly, Arabs living in Israel have more rights, liberty, freedom than any Arabs in any surrounding country.
Yeah.
And far and away more than they have under the Palestinian Authority or under Hamas. That's the voice of Kevin McCullough, national radio host and best-selling author. So go to my website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. Click on the banner. That means all of you sitting here, if you haven't signed, you didn't realize when you came today, you can't leave without signing up for the Israel trip, May 20th to 30th. Again, a word to our friends in New York. If you just tuned in, we're at 1865 Broadway, the wonderful facilities of American Bible Society. Please come and join us. I'll be joining host Kevin McCullough on his show next, and then beginning at 4, talking about Authentic Fire, Hyper Grace, my two new books, and doing a book signing as well and taking your questions. Kevin, I just want to respond to one great question that has been asked. It's in Matthew 15, and it's one has a parallel in the Mark, the 7th chapter. And it's one that raises a lot of questions for believers because it tells the account of a Syrophoenician woman. Jesus goes all the way up to the Tyre Sidon region there. There is a woman who comes to him begging him, please help my daughter. She's demonized. She's terribly sick. And Jesus ignores her. And the disciples get upset, you know, and send her away, send her away. And she keeps persisting. She keeps persisting. And he says, I'm not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And he even goes as far as saying it's not meat, it's not fit to take the children's bread and cast it to dogs. I've debated rabbis, and they said, look, Jesus called the Gentiles dogs, and how could that be a savior? How could he be sinless? As the end result, she says, yeah, but the dogs can eat the crumbs that fall from the table. And he says, great is your faith, your daughter's healed, right? Here's what's fascinating. The parallel, Mark 7, Matthew 15, they both start with the same issue. It's the issue of hand washing. And some of the Jewish leaders come to Jesus and they say, how come your disciples don't wash their hands like the disciples of the Pharisees do? And this was Jewish custom to this day. You know, a Jewish person will wash their hands in a ritual way and say a certain blessing before eating. How come you haven't done that? And he begins to explain how their traditions have made void the word of God.
Hmm.
And then he ends up by saying it's not that which goes into the person that defiles, but it's what comes out of the heart. And it ends Matthew 15. The account ends by him saying that to eat with unwashed hands doesn't defile. The account ends in Mark's gospel with a gloss where Mark adds an explanatory comment. He therefore made all foods clean. In other words, by saying that what you eat doesn't defile you, even though he didn't say go eat unkosher food, he's explaining that the food itself doesn't defile. Why were the food laws given to Israel, Leviticus 11, Deuteronomy 14? A key reason they were given was to keep Israel separate from the nations. These were not like commandments like don't murder or don't commit adultery, universal law commandments. These were separation commandments. So the food laws had to do with separation. What does Jesus then do? He travels a round trip of between 50 and 60 miles up into this Gentile region, and he heals one person and leaves. He is thereby making a statement of walls of partition coming down. His earthly mission was to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And because Israel is called to be a light to the nations, he dies for the sins of the world. And then Jewish emissaries now take that message to the nations. So first his mission is to Israel. Mm-hmm. But he's also showing how there's no clean, unclean in God's sight based on ethnicity. And what he does is draw out faith from this woman. When you realize he makes this whole round trip in the plan of God just to heal a Gentile woman's daughter and to leave, rather than it being a negative, what he's doing is giving her every reason to not receive, and she's persevering through, and he's now demonstrating how the walls, the barriers, have come down. When you came to faith as a Gentile believer in Jesus, as a little boy, when you started hearing about Jews coming to faith, did that surprise you that there were Jews who believed in Jesus?
I don't think so, because our household was very diverse in this respect. My dad earned a solid, middle income our entire life growing up, and I say solid, it was lower middle income at best. But I remember my parents tithing, and they tithed huge, way more than 10% of what we saw as a family. And they gave not only to their local church, but they gave to organizations that they really felt strongly about were doing God's work. And we gave to a lot of messianic organizations. We gave to Jews for Jesus. We gave to and this was in the early 1970s.
And this is the payback today.
I would see Dad's stack of envelopes of people that he would send checks to every month. $10, $20, $30, $40. But that was a lot of money in the early 70s, and it won't even buy an hour of parking in Manhattan now. But that was a demonstration to me from the beginning that in our household we respected and loved Israel because they played an important part in God's economy. Therefore, they had to be an important part of our life.
Interesting. And would you have any security issues in the Lord if more and more Jews started coming to faith? Would you feel like,
Dr. Brown, you're sitting in the metro area across the planet of this universe that has more messianic Jewish believers in it than any other metro area on the planet. The messianic congregations across the New York tri-state area, these are vibrant people that love the same God and same Yeshua that I do. And I'd love to have even more.
And it's interesting. If you look at some of the really big churches in the city, be it Tim Keller or Carter Collin or Jim Cimbala or Eric Bernard or any of these, they'll tend to have a lot of Jewish believers. And the joke used to be that the biggest messianic congregation in the world was Jack Hayford's church in California, because where he was had so many Jews. He had hundreds and hundreds of Jewish believers. But there is this element where Adam is created, the woman comes out of the man, but since then every man has come out of the woman. There's this mutual indebtedness. Well, the same way the gospel comes to the Jewish people, through the Jews it's going to the Gentiles, and now through the Gentiles it comes back to the Jews. There's this sense of how we need each other, and even the diversity of which we bring, which we talked about in your hour earlier, and the body is so much more enriched when, rather than trying to make everyone into the same corporate blob, if you go to a food court somewhere, they don't mix all the foods together in a blender. If we could have the diversity and the different expressions, and if one group is honoring the Lord on a Saturday, another group on a Sunday, and they're honoring the same Lord, if we could not get hung up on that and say, let's go change the world together in Jesus Yeshua's name, it would be amazing.
I agree with that. Amen.
All right, how do folks stay in touch with you? Those few, maybe three listeners that are not connected with you.
No. If they'd like to be in touch with me, it's easy. KMCRadio@gmail.com is my email address. On Facebook.com/KMC01, on Twitter @KMCRadio, or just Google Kevin McCullough. You can't miss.
And listen, you got his email. I want to encourage you to write him several emails a day with personal questions, with me, because he will write you
now
back.
That I'm a rabbi, I can handle it.
He will write you back personally on everyone.
Two can play at that game, Dr. Brown.
Yes.
You're on with me for another hour coming up here.
But I'm not giving my actual email address. All right, friends, it has been great being with you. Remember to join us, 1865 Broadway. My bottom line today, what God spoke to Abraham, what he spoke to Isaac, that he who blesses you, he'll bless, he who curses, he'll curse. It remains the same today.